Radio 1. Nur für Erwachsene.
Thank you, Ramakrishnan. I have the same problem as all readers. There are so many books that I haven't read yet. And I had hoped that there would be soon a way to extend my reading life. After reading your book, my hopes have sunk considerably. What prompted you to write such a disillusioning book?
I wouldn't call it disillusioning. I would call it a dose of realism in a field that is extremely hyped. So if people read my book, they will see that in the last 50 years, we have made tremendous advances in understanding aging. And understanding is the first step to doing something about it. And so this understanding of the processes of aging is also leading to potential ways to improve our health in old age. And most of it is not about extending life, but it's about giving you more years of healthy life.
On the other hand, I'm very happy to have read your book, because now I will not spend any money on neutral supplements. More importantly, and incredibly fascinating, I know now that there is something in all people that does not die. The information about how a new cell or a whole organism can be built, or to put it unscientifically, in me, like in all of us, lies the immortal story of life, right?
That's true. So, in a sense, the bodies we inhabit die. But you have to remember that we are direct descendants of a life form that started several billion years ago. And there's a continuous, unbroken chain of life from that few billion years ago to us that will continue on to our descendants and to the descendants of every form of life on Earth. So in that sense, you could say life is continuous and has been around for a very long time, even though the bodies that it occupies come and go.
To describe the process of aging, you use a quote from Ernest Hemingway. A man is asked how he went bankrupt, and he answers in two ways, first slowly, then suddenly. To what extent can this declaration of bankruptcy be applied to aging?
So if you think of bankruptcy, it means a gradual loss of solvency. You know, you start spending more than you can have, then you start borrowing, then you pretty soon you're not able to borrow anymore, and that's when you become bankrupt. And aging has some similarities. I wouldn't want to push the analogy too hard, but aging has some analogies in that it's the result. Aging is the accumulation of gradual changes and damage to our molecules, our cells, our tissues, and, you know, eventually our body over time. And when that series of accumulated changes results in a critical systems failure, okay, in the bankruptcy example, it would be that the last bank refuses to give you any more money. Okay, so I think when you have a critical systems failure, then we lose our ability to function as a whole individual. I want to point out two strange things about this. When we are alive, millions of our cells are dying all the time. And in fact, many of those cells have to die in order to keep us alive. The contrary part of that is when we die, most of our cells are still alive at the point of death, which is why you can donate your organs for transplant recipients and so on. So death is a peculiar thing. It's not about every part of your body suddenly dying. It's about suddenly not being able to function as a whole individual.
A sentence that has stuck in my head ever since reading it is, death is the price we pay for sex. What was evolution thinking here?
That was actually a joke, and it's not completely true. Okay, but the idea is that in sexual organisms, the germline, this immortal germline that we spoke about that we have inherited from you know, many billions of years ago, gradually and through our parents, and which will be passed on to our offspring. The germline is separated from the somatic cells, which form the body. And so the germline can continue on, but evolution doesn't care about how long the body survives, as long as it survives long enough to reproduce. So I was making a joke about death being the price of sex.
But let's stick with evolution. The maximum lifespan of our body seems to be limited to 120 years. In other words, it's not in the spirit of evolution that we grew older.
That's right. As I pointed out, evolution doesn't care how long we live. It only cares about whether you can successfully pass on your genes. So in each species, the equation is different. For example, if you're a mouse, there's simply no point in evolution, in the species spending a lot of resources trying to maintain and repair and keep alive the mouse's body so that it lives for 80 years, because long before that, the mouse will be eaten by a predator, or it may starve to death or die of 50 other reasons. And so for the mouse, it has been more advantageous to take those precious resources and put them into growth and reproduction. And so mice grow rapidly, they reproduce rapidly, and then they don't live very long. For larger animals, the equation can be different. In fact, for very large animals, like some whales, they can live for 200 years. And we are somewhere in the middle, but we're actually, if you plot size versus lifespan, that you can fit it, to a kind of power law. We actually are somewhat outliers. So humans actually live quite a bit longer than you might expect for our size. So we're doing quite well.
Like the bats.
Yes. Like the bats. So the bats are interesting because they're the same size as a mouse. Why do they live so much longer? It's because they can fly and they can avoid predators. And they can also, flying means they can have a very broad range for food. They can forage over a wide area.
In your book, you trace the history of attempts and thoughts on immortality. You write about lunatics and prophets in the field. The attempts to freeze bodies in order to bring them back to life in a future in which all sick people can be kept are gruesome, these experiments, and well known. In 1976, that cost $28,000, and you lay in liquid nitrogen. Today, there are other methods, and they are more expensive. Why is it still not a worthwhile investment?
Well, nobody. So this idea comes from a legitimate field of biology called cryopreservation. So biologists have always wanted to be able to freeze samples and keep them alive in the frozen state. And so, for example, we can now freeze eggs, we can freeze embryos, we can even freeze larvae of, for example, of worms or flies and so on. So there are many things that we can freeze. The freezing is not perfect, I should say, but you can freeze and bring back, and thaw them out and still maintain them alive. But this is not easy, and it becomes exponentially harder as the size of the organism increases. So the reason is that we are all filled with water, and when water freezes, it expands, and in the expansion, it destroys the tissues around it. If you try to freeze strawberries, when you thaw them, they will not look like fresh strawberries, okay? So why is it that they're doing this? Well, no one has even demonstrated for a small animal like a mouse to freeze it and bring it back alive. And the way they do this with humans to prevent this water damage is to infuse something like an antifreeze liquid inside the person after they're dead. Well, while they're doing this, the cells are all dying. Their brain cells are not in the same state that they were when the person was alive. And so there is absolutely no evidence for this. Now, you could ask, why do people still, want to do this? But that's
This is kind of superstition. You know, you compare it to the religion of the Egypt. That was kind of superstition. There is another realm, and to preserve the body, it may happen that there is another form of life there.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is due to their feeling that, oh, even if the chance is very, very small, if I'm extremely rich, it doesn't matter. I'll take it. And so most of these people are, you know, usually very rich people. And for them, they say, it's okay. I'll spend this money. It doesn't matter to me, you know, and maybe it works. But it's not realistic at all.
All the miracle cures and freezing methods seem to be much less effective than three methods that are easily achievable for all of us to prolong our lives: healthy eating, exercise, sleep. Why are they so important?
So that again, this advice is very old, but our understanding of why they work has only become obvious in the last few decades. So it turns out that caloric restriction turns off changes several metabolic pathways in a way that improves health in older animals. This has been shown in many different species. And so the idea is that if you eat moderately, maybe you're using those pathways optimally as you age. The other thing about exercise is that exercise is involved in repair and regeneration due to age and also other kinds of stress. And in fact, it can be involved in regeneration of mitochondria, which are the energy producers in our cells. It can be involved in regeneration of muscle, and muscle loss is a big problem with age. So exercise has a large number of benefits. In fact, we probably don't even fully understand all of the benefits of exercise. And sleep is very curious. We think of sleep as something that only applies to mammals who have a brain and eyes or something. But in fact, sleep is prevalent in almost all life forms, even very primitive life forms have a version of sleep. And it turns out sleep is important because during the sleep cycle, that is when the organism repairs a lot of damage and does a lot of maintenance. And that really keeps you healthy. So these three things are very important. But I should add a few other tips if your audience is interested. And that is, there are some diseases that are more likely in old age for which there is very good diagnosis and very good treatment. For example, diabetes, high cholesterol, high blood pressure. These three things, if you check for early, you can really help to stay healthy, in life. Then there are some things like certain kinds of cancers, like colon cancer or breast cancer or prostate cancer. Those cancers, if detected early, dramatically improve your chances. And finally, social scientists have found a curious connection. Social isolation actually worsens your health and increases your mortality. So it's good not to be socially isolated. And also having a sense of purpose, that apparently reduces mortality. And this, nobody really understands the underlying reasons, except we know that the brain interacts in a very complicated way with the rest of the body. And so, it may be doing through these sort of psychophysiological pathways.
What surprises me is that there is still no significant political movement that calls for something like immortality for all. Why don't you think there is no such thing?
Well, I heard that in Germany there is actually a party that wants to spend more money for aging research. Well, it makes sense from an individual point of view, in the sense individuals, we have evolved to want to live because, we just don't want to not exist. And of course, there are good evolutionary reasons for that, because that desire to live is what kept us alive in bad times or in danger. But for society, I'm not sure it's a good thing to have the same people living forever. Imagine, you know, if 50 years from now we were still fighting a Trump election, or we had Mao or Stalin, you know, or people like that. So I would say it's not a great great thing. I think turnover is good for society. Also, a lot of really big intellectual and creative advances in science, mathematics, but also in literature and other branches have come from young people. Mm-hmm. And so you need that turnover, I think, to have a vibrant society. Otherwise, you will have a very stagnant society. I'm not sure it's a good thing.
And you have a writer on your side, Ishiguro, who states that the best novels have been written by young writers.
That's right. He actually, I think he annoyed all his fellow authors. He was speaking at the Hay Festival, and I distinctly remember the author he was sort of arguing about this with was getting quite annoyed because he was somewhat older. And but he was not saying you don't produce good work when you're older. That's not the thing. But sometimes your most insightful, most original work often comes when you're younger. And I think it's not just because of biological aging and our decline of our brain and so on. It's also because when we're young, we're looking at everything with fresh eyes. So we are not biased by a lifetime of prejudice and accumulated prejudice. We are looking at things differently. And that's what often creativity involves.
One last fascinating thought, and you already mentioned it. Studies have shown that having a goal reduces mortality. So I will longer if I decide which books I still have to read.
Yes, I certainly think anything that motivates you, that gives you a reason to be alive, I think is probably a good thing. And so having a list of books to read is definitely good. And I'm planning to close down my research lab next year. So in a sense, I'm going to retire, but I'm going to use that to maybe do things I've always wanted to do, but which I didn't have time to do. And that will, I hope, keep me motivated and be a goal in itself.
You heard it from the Nobel laureate. Prolong your reading list and you grow older.
Well, maybe you stay young. Who knows?
Thank you ever so much.
Thank you.